This is the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's edition of the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP. Today, we have Tim Castell with us. Tim is the Associate Professor of Innovation Management at the University of Queensland Business School. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Roshenka. It's good to be here.
Great. Your research, teaching, engagement work are all based on your study of innovation management. So that's really exciting because I know you're speaking at an event that we go hold and we'll give you more details on that later on. Tim, so tell me a little bit about your background in addition to your study of innovation.
Yeah. So I came to my current career through a crooked path. And it's funny because I did a series of interviews for an online course a couple of years ago where I spoke with all kinds of people doing highly innovative work. And almost every single person said the same thing. So I think there's something about that crooked path part that is an important part of the innovation story. So I had an undergraduate degree in economics, of all things, many, many years ago. And when I finished, I went into business. I was a manager for a bunch of different companies in a bunch of different industries. And I ran various things in, you know, back in America, in New Zealand, and in Australia. The last job that I had here was in a software startup, and I was working in that. And as software startups often tend to do, this one imploded. So that job was finished. And so I was just kind of working out, and we had just moved to Brisbane, my wife and I had, and I was just trying to figure out, what should I do next? And I decided to do an MBA here at UQ. And my goal was to, you know, build a network and build connections and build up my knowledge so that I could move into a new role. And in the course of doing that, we did career development workshops and all kinds of things. And it the two things that kept coming up as things I should do were academia and consulting. And my wife was an academic. And so I thought about that. I said, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And if I'm in a business school, I can do both. And so I went straight from my MBA into a PhD, which is a fairly unusual path. Did that as fast as I could because by then I was getting old. And finished that and was really fortunate enough to be hired into the business school to build the innovation course for the MBA, which was just being introduced at the time. So we were the first MBA program in Australia to have innovation in the program. And I was that was my job. I was hired to do that. And since then, I've just been able to build up this really nice portfolio of work where I you know, I teach innovation, I get to do research on it, I get to engage with companies, all kind, you know, startups, researchers, big organizations, not-for-profits, the whole range, just looking at how can people take ideas and convert those into something that's valuable, which to me is just the best thing in the world to be involved with. So that's kind of my background in a nutshell.
Wow, very interesting. Obviously, innovation is lots of different things to lots of people. But you have a very popular blog website called The Discipline of Innovation. So tell us a little bit about that and why you decided to start that and who it's for and what you cover there.
Yep. So the blog started, I started it in 2009. And it was just after I had run my second executive education course on innovation. And what I realized in running that course was, you know, the people that enrolled were all professionals in various businesses that were trying really hard to work out how can we make our organizations more innovative? How can we embed a culture of innovation? And, you know, it's great to teach that in a one-week intensive course, but to actually do that work requires a sustained effort over an extended period of time. And so my original thought with the blog was that I would just write it as an opportunity to share thoughts with people that had been in my courses so that they could just have kind of continuing contact with ideas and information about being more effective at innovating. So that was the intent behind it. And then I really quickly realized that writing the blog really helped me personally both store ideas that I'd had myself. And then the other thing is a lot of times with an idea, you know, it takes one form in your head, takes a completely different form once it goes out into the world. And if you're an academic, the way that you get the idea from your head out into the world is to write or to talk about it. And so the blog then for me became a really important tool for just working out, what do I really think about all these things? And so I started by writing it for my students, and then it quickly flipped into something that I really just did for myself. And then I was really fortunate that in writing about things that were interesting and important to me, a bunch of other people ended up being really interested in that topic as well. And so, you know, when I started, if I'd had a couple hundred readers that were just my ex-students, I'd have been perfectly happy. And then for a period of time, even if they didn't read, I'd have been perfectly happy because I was just working out ideas. And then the fact that, you know, some of the posts have been read hundreds of thousands of times, and there are a big number of people that subscribe and all the rest of it, it's turned into a really nice tool for connecting with people, sharing ideas, building some community around a set of ideas, and just being able to take the pulse of what's going on with people out in the world that are, you know, on a day-to-day basis grappling with this challenge of innovating and making their organizations more innovative.
Yeah, congratulations. It looks like you really tapped into an area that people really didn't have a lot of information on. So, and it's still going to this day.
It is. Well, it's slowed down a lot over the last few years. So as my administrative responsibilities have increased, my I've always blogged in my free time at you know, in the evenings and the weekends and at home. Over the last few years, I've had enough going on that it's been harder and harder to keep up with it. So I feel bad about that, but I still enjoy writing for the blog when I get an opportunity to do so.
All right. Now here's the main question for you, yep. Tim, what does innovation mean to you?
So it's a tricky question because everyone has their own definition. You know, it's one of those things where if you ask 20 experts or practitioners for their definition of innovation, you'll get 25 different definitions. But the one that I use is I talk about innovation as executing new ideas to create value. And for me, the reason that I like that definition is because for two reasons. One is that you need all three parts to actually innovate. So everyone gets the new idea part. And a lot of people talk about innovation as just being new ideas. So if you go onto Amazon and search for books with innovation in the title, there's something like 90,000 of them now. And every single one of them has a light bulb on the cover, right? Because that's what apparently book art departments think means innovation. And it's really misleading, right? Because the implication of that is if you just have the idea, then you're set. But that's really wrong, right? So it's not just having the idea, you actually have to execute it. You have to make it real, right? So when I talked about, you know, just even writing the blog, it's not enough for me to have an idea and say, oh, this would be a cool thing to talk about. I actually have to work out, how do I tell the story? How do I make it make sense to people? How do I draw some kind of lesson from that that will resonate with the people that need to hear it? Making it real part is critically important for anyone that's working with ideas. So the executing new ideas part is essential. But the most frustrated people in the world are ones that they've had a great idea, they've built it, and then no one cares. And so that's where the third part comes in, to create value, because you have to understand what people need. You have to understand what value your idea will create for people. And oftentimes there's a lag between here's this new idea and here's the point where it really takes off. You know, the first email, I was talking with a friend of mine in the School of IT yesterday. And I said, when did you have your first email address? He said, it was a long, long, long time ago. It was 1991. And then we started thinking about it, right? The email was invented in 1968. And then if you had an email address in 1991, you were an early adopter. And then by 1995, everyone in the world had an email address. And so its adoption curve was really, really flat for 25 years. And then it eventually took off. And over that 25-year period, what people were trying to work out is, what's this good for? You know, what's the value that this actually creates? And so, and that happens with every new thing. You actually have to work out, where's the value in this idea. And if you don't do that, people won't use your thing, whatever it is. And so to me, talking about executing new ideas to create value is the way that I define it. And the other reason that I like that definition is that it also implies both that it's a process and it's a process that takes time. And those are really important as well, because it means that there's no quick fix. If you're trying to become more innovative, you have to have time built into your planning and your approach to it. And you have to build a process that allows people to have good ideas, allows them to act on them, and allows them to interact with the stakeholders that they're trying to serve, so that we're confident that we're actually creating value for as broad a group as possible.
And what would be some of the key principles of innovation that you share with your students?
It's really around those ideas of that I just spoke about, right? So that idea of innovation as a process is critical. So, you know, one organization that I worked with quite a while ago now had really bought into that idea that innovation was just about ideas. And so they bought some idea management software and they asked everybody in their organization, please give us your ideas. And 6 months later, you know, they'd started with zero ideas and in 6 months they had 800. And then after that, they were looking around saying, well, that's weird because nothing's really changed. And it was because there was no process. There was no process for saying, these are the ideas that we want to invest in. There was no method for taking those ideas, putting some resources behind them and testing them out. There was no way for them to interact with stakeholders to figure out which of those ideas might be most valuable and how might that create value for people. And so the critical thing is really building that process for innovating. So that's one core principle. And probably the other one that is often a real stumbling point for both people and organizations, and that is that if you're a business, it doesn't really matter what industry you're in or what size you're in, there are a lot of metrics and a lot of methods and a lot of tools in place to help you be more efficient. And efficiency is important. And you know, we need to be efficient. It's bad to be wasteful. But the issue with innovation is that, right, if you look at the stats on it, if you look at new ideas that are actually executed and go out into the world, if you're a startup, the odds of being around in 3 years are about 9%. If you are an existing company and you launch a new product, the odds of that product succeeding are about 20%. About 20% of new products stick around. If you're a researcher or a scientist and you take out a patent, the percentage of patents that are actually in use is under 2%. The vast majority of ideas that people execute don't work. And so, innovation pretty much by definition is wasteful. You know, I think I was talking with another group a couple of weeks ago and I talked about it as deliberate inefficiency, right? And if you're a manager and all of your metrics are built around being more efficient and saving money and saving costs and saving time, and then somebody else says, yeah, but we need to innovate more, but it's going to hurt all of those other metrics that you're being measured on, that conflict is really hard to resolve. And it turns out that the most successful organizations in the world are the ones that can do both of those things, right? They can be efficient on the one hand while also exploring new ideas. But for really successful organizations, it's not either efficiency or exploration. It's both efficiency and exploration. But it's a really hard thing to manage. And it breaks a lot of people's heads because all of our metrics are around just save time, save money, save on people. And so it's from a management standpoint, it's really challenging. So yeah. when I run classes, that's what we're trying to get at. What are some methods and techniques that help you address that problem?
Okay. And when you do speak to business leaders, they obviously have, some common questions they ask you around innovation. Yeah. What are those?
A lot of it depends on the level that they're at. And so when I teach courses, like in MBA courses or exec ed, a lot of the people in the classroom are mid to high level managers, right? All of them are managers one way or another. They're often not the top level managers, but you know, they might be on a senior leadership team or a layer or two below that. Their most common question is, all this sounds great and I would love to innovate more, but my manager won't let me. So what do I do? That's the most common question. You know, and so the way that I answer that one is that you need to work. You know, so again, if you're in an organization that values efficiency, and then you go to your manager and say, "Hey, I've got this great new idea, and if it works, it'll be great, and if it doesn't, we'll lose a chunk of money, and I'm not sure if it's going to work or not." What's the rational? You know, of course, the rational answer is, "Well, no, we won't do that," right? So that's a challenge, and so one of the things that you have to do if you're at that level is you just have to figure out how can I run experiments within my span of control. So if I have budget signing authority of $10 or $100 or $2,000 or whatever, what experiments does that allow me to run? And can I generate a process of innovation within those boundaries? If you go up a couple layers, you know, the senior managers ask a different question. They say, "I really want my organization to be more innovative, but my people won't act." Right. So on the one hand, you have people saying, "My manager won't let me." And then at the layer above that, the people say, "My people won't do what I want them to, you know, they won't try stuff." Right. And so part of it is we've got misaligned incentives. But the other thing is that a lot of times at a top level, you know, people want more innovation, but they don't want to actually change anything. And that's a real problem as well, because, you know, it by definition, if you're innovating, it changes the way you operate. It changes your processes. It changes your metrics. It changes you. And so people have to be willing to engage with that, to allow it for the people that report to them, and to encourage it for their peers and themselves.
And we're hopefully emerging out of the pandemic now, but during the pandemic, obviously, people have been distracted. There have been new challenges that have come to the fore for businesses, and their people had to reinvent themselves. In those kinds of challenging times, how important is it to keep innovating?
It's really important for several reasons, and you know, I think the last 2 years have been really hard for everyone. It's been a great time to be a monopoly, especially if it's a digital monopoly, because those companies have been printing money for 2 years. For almost everyone else, it's been a real struggle one way or another. And so in answering this, I don't want to make light of any of the difficulties or challenges that people have faced over that time, because we felt it here at the university. And others have felt it even more severely in other sectors. But when something like this happens, it points to sort of two things. One is that there's an awful, awful, awful academic phrase, and I promise this is the only one that I'm going to use while we're talking, and it's a thing called absorptive capacity. And what that means is researchers have looked at innovation and innovative firms and innovative people. And what they found was that organizations' ability to adapt to changing circumstances and to bring in new ideas is directly dependent upon the amount of effort they put into generating, acting, and implementing new ideas themselves. And so what that means is that if you're regularly trying to innovate, if you're regularly trying to make your organization better, when we hit times like this, you're more likely to be able to try new things, to change and adapt to the changing circumstances, and to succeed. And so, you know, one really simple example is that here in Australia, at least, well, I think probably globally, but certainly in Australia, it's been a really tough couple of years for restaurants, you know, and a lot of them have just flat out disappeared. And the ones that succeeded are the ones that adapted really quickly. And so even some very high-end restaurants that, you know, have their value proposition for years has been, come in and we'll give you a fantastic experience. They figured out a way to adapt to do takeaway and to provide other forms of experience to their customers, even though it was radically different than the way that they tended to operate previously. And most of the restaurants that did that had been innovative before, right? It, you know, you can't get to an emergency and then start innovating. It has to be something that you're doing all the way along, because that builds up that absorptive capacity. You can bring in new ideas, adapt them, and implement them in place. Here in Brisbane, at least, there I know a couple of pizza restaurants that went out of business because somehow in the middle of the pandemic, they weren't able to switch from being a dine-in pizzeria to doing takeaway pizza. If any category of food is built for, you know, take the idea of takeaway was built around pizza, and yet they couldn't make that relatively straightforward change to their operating model because they were locked into this is what we do and this is how we do it. And so they couldn't adapt to a changing environment. So innovating and regularly trying to make things better and test things out, it's a way to stay in tune with a shifting environment. And sometimes the environment, most of the time, that environment is shifting gradually and you might not even notice it. And then every once in a while, something really radical happens, like a global financial crisis or a pandemic. And then that's when having that innovation capacity becomes really important.
Now, you deal with a number of businesses and obviously you observe the kinds of innovation that they conduct, but also you work with some businesses. Do you want to relay some of the best examples that you've seen?
Yeah, I think the best examples are ones that I can't identify by name due to confidentiality, but there have been two big projects that I've worked on that I really learned a lot on. One, and there's some parallels between them. So both of them were organizations that I ended up engaging with over an extended period of time, so 24 to 36 months. And in that time, what we really focused on was building programs that supported a process of innovation. So not just idea generation, but also some method of selecting ideas, some method for implementing them. And investing in them. And then once everything worked out, some method for getting that idea out to people so that they could adopt them and start using them. And the thing that was interesting about both of those instances, some of the common factors there, one was that they had both top-down support. So in both instances, the project sponsor was the CEO. And they had senior leadership team support behind the CEO's desire to make the organization more innovative. But at the same time, they also had very intensive frontline participation and contribution to the program. So they had both the top down and, I don't like the term, but bottom up participation in the program. And that I think is critical for making these kinds of programs work. The other thing that was really interesting about it is that in one of them, the CEO was the sponsor, but the team that I was working with most closely was the learning and development team. And the director of L&D kept saying, you know, this is great that we're doing these programs and we're getting high levels of participation and all the rest of it, but when is it going to start showing up in our culture? And I kept saying, well, once you have about 10% of your people that have gone through one of our programs and that have consciously tried to become more innovative, that's about the point where you'll see measurable changes in the culture. And it took about 24 months. And it was actually when they were at about 12% of people in the organization that had gone through one of these programs. And all of a sudden, there was nothing. And then in the annual culture survey, it just flipped, went from, we don't think of ourselves as innovative, to almost the entire organization thinks that we're innovative, you know. And then there were measurable changes in people's buy-in to the overall strategy of the organization, their commitment to it, and a whole range of things. And so the two lessons that I drew from that were that, first off, it inevitably takes time. It's really hard to do any kind of innovation intervention that is short that will genuinely make a difference. The second thing is that in addition to taking time, there's just a critical mass. And it's someplace between, you know, having 5 to 10% of people in the organization participating. And so once you get to that point, that's what creates an inflection point where the values and the viewpoints that are being generated from participating in that process radiate out to even people that aren't directly involved with it. So it's commitment at the top, the ability to participate and contribute directly for everyone, an extended period of time, and then a critical mass of contribution. If you get all those things working, then you can change your culture and you can actually become more innovative.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tim. I think we might finish up there. Now, we're very excited because you are going to be joining SAP Effect in Brisbane on the 4th of November. Yep. And you'll be there in person. I know that's not a huge thing for Brisbaneites, but for the rest of the states, that is a big thing. So we'll be holding an event called Effect in the SAP office in Brisbane. So everyone is most welcome to attend. You can register by visiting our website, sap.com/Australia/Effect. That's EFFECT. And it's free to register. Tim, really appreciated you joining us today and look forward to hearing your talk on innovation coming up at Effect.
Thanks, Roshenka.
Thanks. You've been listening to the Best Run podcast brought to you by SAP.
You've been listening to the Best Run podcast brought to you by SAP.